So good evening, everyone. I'm broadcasting live January 1st, 2016. Right? We're going to do a Dhammapada video. And then we'll answer some questions as well. So the first part, there will be no video. Test. Okay. Hello and welcome back to our study of the Dhammapada. Today we continue on with verse 123. Which reads as follows: Vani jova bhayang mangam appasatto mahadano visang jivita kamo va papani parivanjaye. Which means, just as a merchant relates to dangers on the path, or a dangerous path, when he has appasatto, few weapons or few defenses, mahadano, but great wealth. Or, just as a person, jivita kama, one who desires to live, relates to poison. Papani parivajaye, one should avoid evil. So we have two analogies here. The first is a merchant, how a merchant avoids a dangerous path, a merchant who has little defenses but great wealth. And the second is a person desiring to live, avoids poison, doesn't eat or drink poison. In the same way, we should avoid evil. Simple verse. It's also a fairly simple story. It's actually not so much related. This is another example of how the Buddha used a story to, as it seems, as an excuse to give a teaching, relating some fairly unmeaningful discussion, turning it into meaningful teaching. So the story goes that there were these thieves who were trying to rob this very rich merchant. And he went out on travels, but he took monks with him. So he had lots of supplies, and he invited monks to travel with him, which was convenient for the monks because he would have supplies for them. When traveling, it's hard to find a place and to know where to go for alms. So when a monk is staying in a village, they acquire people who support them, who treat them as a part of their society and give them food. But when a monk goes to a new place, I mean, even in a Buddhist country, this is still the case. When you go to a new place, it's hard to expect that you're going to receive alms, or more especially when you're traveling. So they went with his merchant, who said that he would care for them and feed them along the way. So they went together. There was a whole bunch of monks. The commentary says 500, but I think 500 is just code for a large group. And he got to a certain village and was resting there when these thieves caught up with him and lay in wait so that when he left the village they would be able to rob him. And they waited and they didn't see him coming through the village, so they assumed he was there. They wanted to find out when he was going to leave so they could prepare an ambush and rob him. And so one of the thieves went to a friend he had in the city and asked him about it, and the man found out for him. I went to the merchant and asked him. And found out and told them that in 2 days the merchant was going to set out, and so this thief went back to his friends and got them all ready. And then the merchant, this friend of his, somehow, it's kind of strange actually. I maybe should read the Pali, but the English as it's written, he goes to the merchant and lets the merchant know, which is reasonable. To that extent, it's understandable, because it's like he feels guilty, especially he mentions that there's 500 monks with this merchant, so there's a large group of monks with this merchant. So if he doesn't warn the merchant, it's not just going to hurt the merchant, but it's also going to impact, hurt, and maybe kill some of these monks. So he goes and tells the merchant that there's a band of thieves lying in wait for him. So all well and good, but then the thieves come back to the guy, and he tells them basically that the merchant has changed his mind. The merchant decides to head home. So he turns around and prepares to head out the other gate. And he tells the thieves this, which is kind of strange how he's talking to both sides. So the thieves turn around, go to the other side of the village, and they prepare an ambush on the road back. And the man goes back to the merchant and lets him know that. Maybe something's lost in the translation. It seems like odd behavior to me. But anyway, it's just a story. Finally, the merchant, not being able to go forward, and now knowing that if he goes back, same thing's going to happen, and that he really doesn't have the defenses, says to the monks, "Look, I think there's no reason for me to move on. I'm just going to stay here in this village, set up and sell my wares here, see how I can do, because clearly there's danger waiting for me if I leave." And so the monks, hearing this, discussed among themselves and decided there was no way they could continue along the path, and the best thing for them was to return back to the Buddha, which they did. When they came to the Buddha, they told him this story, and the Buddha used this as an excuse, or as an example, a comparison, to say, "Look, here's a guy who knows danger when he sees it. And so he doesn't set out on the path when there's danger on the path. And likewise, you all who desire good and who understand the danger of evil should refrain from evil, just as," and then he gives a second example, "a person who desires to live would avoid poison." So that's the backstory, short backstory, and that's the verse. So how does this, what does this mean? How does it relate to our practice? Well, the word bhaya is interesting, because we talk about the dangers, and we're always talking about how bad evil is, right? It's doing evil is a bad thing, doing good is a good thing, right? But it may not be clear exactly what is wrong with doing bad deeds. What is wrong with being an evil person? What is wrong with taking advantage of people? And maybe even more difficult, what is wrong with indulging in pleasure, sensual pleasure in general? What's wrong with it? Why do we consider that to be quote unquote evil? This is because of the dangers. There are four dangers in the performance of evil deeds. Or if you don't like the word evil, though it is the word they use, you could understand by the definition of evil in Buddhism, it just means unwholesomeness, or that which leads to suffering, or that which has danger, that which is not worth doing. So there are four dangers that we talk about. There's actually 12 dangers, but four of them are specifically related to people doing evil deeds. There's four dangers that all beings have to face, These are birth, old age, sickness, and death. Birth means if you you have to, if you die, you have to be born again. And there's four dangers that people performing good deeds have to deal with. So people who have engaged in spiritual practice, these are the evils of anger, the evils of sensual pleasure, the evil of sexual desire, and the evil of laziness, I believe. But the four that we're concerned with here are the dangers that are that present themselves to people who perform evil. What's the problem with it? Well, the big one that we always point to is when you pass away. You know, if you kill someone in this life, people understand in Buddhism that it means someone's going to come back and kill you in the next life. It's not always like that, but we understand there's some future birth consequences, or there's some ultimate consequences. Without that, it's true that there's a potential problem with Buddhist theory, because you could outrun the consequences. If you do all sorts of unwholesome deeds or cultivate all sorts of addictions to sensuality and pleasure, then just when you turn like 65 or as you start to age, you can just say, enough of that, and kill yourself. Or, you know, whatever, you can live out your life and not have to face the consequences. If there were no future existence, if desire didn't have the potential to relink, you know, to create more, if desire didn't have the potential to create, really, but specifically the potential to create more life, then you'd be able to get off scot-free. There wouldn't be too much danger. But even still, before we look at that, there are three other types of dangers that only relate to this life. The first is self-censure. Attanovada. The blaming yourself. So the Buddha said, just like a blanket, our deeds cover us when we're alone. If we do good deeds, there's a warm, comfortable blanket. If we do bad deeds, it's a heavy, uncomfortable shroud covering us. And this is certainly true, something that you can see for yourself based on the deeds that you do. It's something that we see very clearly in meditation, that the good deeds that we do and the bad deeds that we do do cover us and go along with us. They follow us. The bad deeds follow us like a ball and chain. Good deeds lift us up, lighten our load, lighten our step. They change us. They're a change in direction. Every ethical act that we perform changes the direction that we're going. It affects our life. It sends out ripples into the universe. It changes how people look at us. Well, first of all, it changes how we look at ourselves. The second one is how other people look at us. So the other thing it changes. Evil deeds are parasovada. They lead other people to scold us and to blame us and to censure us, to look down upon us. It leads to tension and friction. Even just sensuality, greed. When we're greedy, it means we need a portion of something. We need something for ourselves. If someone else wants it, then we have a conflict, and we have to resolve it either by fighting over it or by suppressing our desires and relinquishing it. But either way, it leads to suffering. Even to give other people something that you want is a cause for suffering. It torments you because you want it and you can't have it. And the third one is punishment, that there is punishment that comes. So that when we break laws, or when we kill, when we break ethical rules and maxims, not only is there censure, but there's also punishment. So we might lose friendships, or it might lead to fighting, it might lead even to criminal punishment. There are many dangers to doing evil deeds that you can see in the here and now. Now, about the fourth one, the fourth danger, which is in the future life, it really bears examining, and it helps us, and it gives us a chance to talk about how this all relates to our meditation practice. Because the big problem with unwholesome deeds is that they're productive. And that's how we look at our life. Life isn't a thing, it's not atomic, like, hey, I'm a being and I'm alive. Life is caused by, it's continued. It's a conservation, as they say. Not only are we alive, but we're being born every moment, right? Because there really is no logically inherent reason to think a priori that just because we are alive now, we're going to be alive in the next moment. So there's something that's keeping us alive, and not only alive, but there are many things that are determining which direction we take in our lives. Some are choices that we make, some are that which is imposed upon us. And one of the things that influences that is our desire. Now, without desire, you would still be alive. Without greed, anger, and delusion, one continues to live on. But many of the aspects of one's life that would be created with greed and based on greed, anger, and delusion will not be created. So an enlightened being lives by necessity a very simple life. They aren't able to go out and make money and work and so on, because that part of life, that the impetus that creates that part of life isn't there. And so that's how we look at in general, at unwholesome and wholesome deeds. When you want something, you create a whole new aspect of your life involved with getting that. And it can often be quite complex. The drive to attain and all the work that you have to do, and the planning and manipulation of others even, and all of the many things you have to do, you end up committing yourself. Like when you want a big house, then you commit yourself to a loan. If you want a car, when you fall in love with another person, you get married and you start a whole new there's a whole new thing that is born. And so the idea of rebirth is really that's I don't think it would be acceptable evidence, but it is the evidence. If you understand reality, it's the evidence for rebirth, is this productive potential for karma. When you have desire, it creates, it manifests something in your life. And that's all that's left. On the other side, the brain and the body and external stimulus altogether is also capable of creating life or thought or experience. You can, when you hear something, the sound triggers the experience of hearing in the mind, the consciousness to arise in at the ear. Now when you die, all of that becomes unproductive, unable to produce experience. But the desire is still perfectly capable of creating new experience. It's all that's left. And so that is what the fact is, that is what creates the next life. I mean, there's no traveling to be born in a womb or something. There's a restarting with just a single two cells starting to create something. So the mind and the body working together. That's for humans. Now for angels, for other types of beings in hell and so on, it's spontaneous. But it's spontaneous based on our desires, our attachments. A person without desires, when they pass away, all the productive capability of the body ceases. The productive capability of the mind has already ceased in terms of karma. And so they pass away, and there is no rebirth. So that's a little bit off track, but that's the danger. The danger is that we'll have to be reborn again. Now, for many people, that sounds quite exciting. They think, wow, great, I can be reborn again. And when we talk about heaven and so on, that's great as well. That's a good reason to be reborn because, hey, we can be reborn in heaven. But it ignores the danger, or we must never forget about the danger of evil. And so that is what this verse reminds us of, that there are consequences. And just as we would avoid other things that have danger and have great potential to cause harm, like poison or a dangerous road for a rich merchant, we should guard ourselves and we should avoid the path of evil. How we do this, this is how it relates to our meditation, is because the way that we do this is through the practice. I mean, this is very much what Buddhist practice is based on, avoiding evil. Buddhism isn't a philosophy where you're just trying to explore the universe or become some spiritual being with all sorts of high-minded thoughts. It's specifically to be free from evil, be free from suffering, and to cultivate good. So this is very, this is completely the, this is the basis of Buddhist practice. We give charity, it's to help us overcome greed. We practice morality, it's to help us overcome anger, mostly, also greed. And we practice meditation, insight meditation, to overcome delusion. The clarity of mind, it frees us from our ego and conceit and arrogance and wrong views and beliefs of all sorts. All of this is the practice of the Buddha's teaching. It's how we avoid evil. So when you give gifts, you're training yourself in generosity. And moreover, you're seeing the benefits of generosity. You're able to see your attachments and how much suffering comes from it. When you give something, often you don't want to, and you cringe and think, oh, I want that for myself, or you feel like you want. But you overcome that. And by overcoming it, you see what the real problem is. The problem is not losing what you want. The problem is this wanting that is really an evil, unpleasant, unwholesome state. And when you practice morality, you start to see how frustrated we get when something doesn't go our way and how we want to lash out or hurt others. And so it helps us cultivate patience and helps us overcome anger. We get to see the problem with anger because we don't follow it. And we get to change and become more patient rather than attacking or hurting others or hurting ourselves. And when we practice meditation, we see all of this in much more clarity. We see moment by moment how things arise. We start to see patterns. We see how our behavior is hurting ourselves very clearly. This meditation is actually quite a simple thing, but it can be the most traumatizing, unpleasant experience because our minds are quite messed up for the mo if we've never trained them. Our minds become lazy and chaotic, messy, cluttered. And so through the meditation practice, we sort these out, reminding ourselves, this is this, this is this, this is this, and it's about sorting things into what they really are and seeing the chaos of the mind and the automatic adjustment that comes from seeing the danger and the problems and things. So, this is our teaching tonight from the Dhammapada. I think we'll stop it there. Basic teaching: avoid evil. Avoid it like the plague. Avoid it like poison. Avoid it like an evil. And it's a neat the just one more little thing, the how it does relate to the story of the merchant It's about staying still, about being centered. This village, it's kind of a nice analogy of staying in the village where peace and happiness reign instead of being greedy and going off and looking for more. So that's about living our lives existentially, in a sense, instead of seeking out pleasure chasing it or following after our aversion, not following after desire or aversion. Stay present. Don't follow an evil path. Don't go looking for trouble. So that's all. That's the Dhammapada for tonight. Thank you all for tuning in. Okay, we're ready to go live with video. I can get my mouse working. Hello everyone. Broadcasting live video. January 1st, 2016. We've just recorded the first Dhammapada video, my first recording of 2016. I better get that out. Yesterday's recording, remember that 1 minute, for those of you who were here during that, or have, now it's actually on YouTube, which is kind of silly, but that 1 minute video has been watched. Two people watched it. So it has officially been viewed by TEDx. Maybe this is my first step to giving a TED talk. Tomorrow I'm going to Stony Creek. There's, I think it's the head monk's mother's birthday. It's kind of a New Year's celebration. It's a Sunday. And then Monday I'm going to Toronto in the morning for a meeting. They're putting together a new certificate program at Emmanuel College in Toronto, University of Toronto, for non-degree students, practitioners, so people who may not even have a degree but are looking for a certificate in Buddhism, practical Buddhism. So we think it would be in conjunction, with Buddhist organizations who would train people, and these people would have to qualify, maybe do a write-up or something, and get graded, or I'm not sure how it would be set up. Fuzzy again. So anyway, I've been invited to be on the steering committee, the organizing committee. I'm not sure really why. I think it's because I've talked at a couple of these meetings, and I have the ability to do stuff with words. They like when I talk. Got a lot of experience organizing, and it's interesting. I mean, even before I was a monk, I was involved with student leadership since I was 14. I was doing student leadership conferences, and I got on the youth parliament I've always done this kind of, and then organizing as a, once I became a monk, doing organization for meditation courses, got a lot of experience, strangely enough. Anyway, so that's Monday. And then Tuesday, I think, is my first day of classes. That's my life. We got lots of people signing up for meetings. So, couple new people anyway. Let's take a look. So for those of you who, yeah, there's only four available slots. So I'm not gonna bother making a video or advertising it, because then we're just gonna get people complaining that there aren't enough slots. So let's just keep quiet. It's our secret. Four slots is fine. Four empty slots. I mean, some of these people are gonna be done soon. And today's 6:30 appointment didn't show up. Doug? Or is Doug finished? Maybe Doug's already finished. I can't remember. He's still on the list though. Maybe I should just take him off. I can't remember. Some people call me and tell me they can't make it, and I just say, okay. Like Sunday, someone can't make it. Can't remember who. Hemant, I think. So that's neat. That's a neat system. Right. Shehan came by today with 700 books. So they're in my room now. And they're going to come in handy for the 5-minute meditation. You guys saw that I posted the poster. We got a banner that's like big, and starting mid-January, hopefully, we're going to do 5-minute meditation lessons at the university. It's a bunch of announcements. Do we have any questions? I think we do, right?
We do have questions, Bhante.
Oh, wait, give me a second. I just make sure we're recording properly. Yeah. Okay, I think we're recording properly. Go ahead.
Okay. Hi, can you please explain the difference between noting a phenomena and being aware of it? Which one happens first as one meditates? Thank you.
This is Mahmoud, right?
Yes.
Okay, well, I was saying he's asked a lot of questions and hasn't yet logged any time, which is fine. But I want to be sure that he's actually meditating and meditating in this tradition, because he hasn't posted anything. So Robin says she can vouch for him as practicing in our tradition. So I'll answer the question, but I want to just make sure that this person's actually meditating.
I'll check with them. But just for newer people, if anyone missed it, we actually, do log in our time. It's just right at the bottom of the page. So just plug in your time and hit start.
When you meditate, try to log it here if you can. I don't log all my meditation here. I'm trying to, but I get interrupted and stuff, so it's not always convenient. Anyway, I mean, there's a really big difference. I mean, it's not, if you think about it, it's not that hard to see the difference. Noting is an act, that's an artificial act. Awareness is something that happens all the time. When you like something or you dislike something, you're aware of it first, right? Awareness comes there as well. The problem is when people try to use the word awareness to mean something more, like somehow one is, what do you call, is intentionally aware, which it's just too vague to really pin down as being this or that or the other thing. I mean, you're always aware. So when you say intentionally aware or just aware, then the question is, what exactly is the difference? So that would be confusing when you have meditation where people say, just be aware. Don't react to it, just be aware of it. Question is, well, how do you do that? And it's through noting, this artificial practice that we claim that is accomplished. Noting comes after you're aware. After you're aware of something, you remind yourself, which is the meaning of sati, that is that. That is, you know, pain is pain, seeing is seeing, thinking is thinking, sitting is sitting. And that's it. And that act of reminding yourself again and again, every time you experience it, pain, or thinking, is what creates, or not creates, is what prevents anything but awareness from arising. So all that arises is just bare awareness. This is the tool that leads you to be simply aware. So, I mean, it's a good question, but I think it's fairly easy to see if you're objective about it.
Hello, I have a couple of questions this evening. I am new to meditation. I find I'm easily distracted by noise around me when meditating. I have two dogs, for example, and their barking distracts me. How should I deal with this when meditating? Should I simply acknowledge my distraction and continue on? I also wanted to thank you. While I am not well versed in meditation, your videos have helped me through tough times in my life with regard to anxiety, and I appreciate what you do.
Sound, for example, is a proper meditation object, so you can meditate on the sound, just saying to yourself, hearing. Like, don't let it be a distraction, have it be your meditation, which I suppose seems kind of strange, but this whole meditation must seem kind of strange if you're not clear on what's going on in your mind. You would have no reason, why would I want to focus on the sound? What's going to happen? Is it something magical or so on? What's special about the sound of my dogs barking? You can become enlightened listening to your dogs barking. That's how special it is. But that seems weird and it seems strange, and how could that possibly be? It comes because that the sound is an experience that arises and ceases, and your mind gets involved with it and reacts to it. And so just by listening to the sound, you can see all of the aspects of your mind. See how your mind works, you can begin to adjust your mind, begin to see how that the truth of reality is just experiences. So the whole idea of dogs barking is, sort of, is 99% conceptual. The only piece of it that's real is the sound of the ear. Everything else is real in terms of being a thought in the mind, but the only reality of it is it's being a thought, or reactions, emotions, and so on. Absolutely, just meditate on the sound, hearing. If your mind eventually gets so it's not interested in the sound anymore, then you can ignore it and come back again to the stomach rising and falling. But try to note the sound for until it goes away, or until your mind starts to become disinterested in it.
If you kind of can't help reacting, would you switch your object of meditation to your reaction?
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to jump around too much, eventually come back to the stomach, but note at least that, reactions and so on.
I should have read this part with it as well. Would it be more beneficial to try and find a place more quiet without distraction to meditate?
No, I wouldn't do that.
There happens to be a Laotian Wat 10 miles from my home, and I'd like to spend time there. Would you please give guidance with basic etiquette and observances? I've only been to one Wihara in the past. Thank you for your consideration, Bhante.
I'm not Lao. I'm not Laotian. I have to ask them. It's tough because I'm so much more lax than all these places, so I'm not much good to you, I'm afraid. I mean, I know some of the, I know how to behave, I suppose. I suppose I'm just shirking my responsibility. But it's hard for me to really talk about all these ridiculous, silly rules that places have.
Well, I go to Alyosha Wat Bantu, so
You can tell them. How do you
if you want
behave
to
in that
pass this one
situation?
off on me, I'd be happy to.
Please go ahead.
The Wat that I go to, they actually have a sign posted on the wall with basic etiquette, and I love how simple they make it. Call the monks Ajahn, sit on your legs. So in other words, you don't sit cross-legged; you actually sit on your legs during the time that you're there. Take off your shoes. That's the first one. Those are the ones that are listed. I found out the hard way by making some mistakes, but everyone was always very, very nice and helped me out. And just a couple of other things, and I imagine this is fairly common. But don't walk in front of the monks. Show respect by moving to the side and letting the monks move forward. And then with food, the monks would eat first, and then the lay people eat after the monks are completely done. So it's a little bit different, but I found people very friendly and very willing to help me out
Okay, I guess
because
the
I
reason
really
I
didn't know
don't
what I was
want the
doing.
reason I don't want to relate all that is because it makes it sound like somehow that's, I mean, people always take this to be Buddhist rules, right? And there's a lot of thought that there's an obligation or an expectation, and there is no expectation. And I try my best. My view is, and my impression I want to give people is that there are no expectations on you. Monks have a lot of expectations on them. And I think the only expectation is a respectful attitude. I find it surprising sometimes how disrespectful. And, you know, it's not like you have to hold monks as above you, but you should be respectful of the fact that they are ordained. They're not in society, so you shouldn't treat them as your pal and, you know, want to shake their hands or hug them or, you know, joke with them or so on. It doesn't have to mean putting them above you, if you, I mean, many people do, and that's fine if you think of them as spiritual leaders or whatever, but as separate, as like you would a priest. You know, in modern Western culture, there's a real sense of equality and of treating people just as people and disregarding all of this pomp and ceremony and so on. I sympathize with that for the most part, but I think there is, I mean, we should respect. I just think we should respect, be respectful for people in general, and be respectful of their situation. Monks have a specific situation, just like priests or rabbis, and I take that all very seriously. When I meet a rabbi or a priest, I respect their path, you know, and I try not to infringe upon it. So for monks, it's, I think that's all, the only one rule you should keep in mind. I mean, obviously there's many more in the monastery, but general rule of thumb is it's a monk and they're doing something fairly specific, so at the very least, leave them alone. Don't get too close or chummy or think of them as, you know, your pal or something. Think that's important.
Even with lay people, I've done a little reading and, about Laotian people and, and also just things people have indicated to me. Not really, it's not really a situation where you go up and hug someone or anything. There's a little bit of distance. And definitely when people are doing an overnight meditation or on eight precepts, you wouldn't touch someone of the opposite sex at all. You wouldn't shake hands or anything like that.
Yeah, that's a good point. When you're on eight precepts, and many people are, there's generally no contact, at least not between genders.
There's also a scarf, like an upper body scarf that people wear. It's called pabiang, and it's worn diagonally across the chest. The pabiang, yeah, the right shoulder is kept bare, and you wear it across the chest. And everyone wears it, men, women, and children, and no one seems to know why. It's just habit or tradition, but everyone wears them. And I didn't think that. I thought it might seem odd if I wore one, but right away people were saying, "Oh, you should wear one. This is where you can get one. I'll bring you an extra one." So I wear one as well. It seems to be some sort of a respectful gesture, but no one knows exactly why. Bhante, I have difficulty to know if I control my breath or not. It's not clear. What should I note? Thanks.
I'm not quite clear on what you're asking. Not quite clear on what you're asking. You should be noting the rising and the falling. If you find yourself trying to control the breath, you should note knowing, or if you're frustrated about it, say frustrated, or if it's unpleasant, which control often is, you can say unpleasant, or I've got a good word in Thai, ut-at. We don't have such a word in English. Feeling is fine.
And we're all caught up on questions. Unless Rukola wanted to put a little more detail on the question.
This person had a good answer. If you're not sure whether you're controlling the breath, then note the doubt. That's a good answer. Note to yourself doubting. Okay, that's all then. Have a good night. Thank you, Robin, for your help.
Thank you, Bhante. Good night.